in Madison's Overture Center this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the Madison Symphony and the dazzling violinist, James Ennis. Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and welcome back to the Midday, James Ennis.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You've obviously made quite a track around the country, if not the world, in the last 3 years since we've seen you. So what have you been up to?
Well, keeping busy. I remember very clearly it was exactly the same time of year because I was spending all my free time watching baseball, and that's what I'm doing now, too.
What do you think about those Cubs?
Oh, that's pretty exciting. Yeah. I have a very good friend who's been living and dying with the Cubs his entire life, season tickets and all that.
That's a long life.
And, he is about as excited as I've seen him.
Baseball aside, though, you were here 3 years ago to play the Bartok, I think, second violin.
Yeah, that's right.
Something quite different this time.
Yeah, the Max Brooks Scottish Fantasy, I think that's, in a certain sense, about as different as you can get from Bartok. But in another sense, I mean, you think that Bartok was a composer so influenced by folk music. And here this Scottish Fantasy
True.
Is, of course, hence the name, inspired and makes use of Scottish melodies. I mean, it's a wonderful piece, a piece that I fell in love with as a teenager, I suppose, through the great recordings of Jascha Heifetz. And maybe it's not a piece that gets heard all that much anymore, which is kind of a shame because I think it's really great fun to listen to, great fun to play.
You say it's great fun. Are there particular challenges in this?
Technically, it's certainly very involved. It was written for, I think it was written for Sarasate, if I remember.
One of the great
virtuosi.
Yeah. In fact, we're going to hear something by him shortly that you record.
So it's certainly, it makes great use of all the virtuoso things a violin can do. But it's a piece I've known for long enough it's challenging, but it's really, it feels very internalized, and it's something that I definitely enjoy a very great deal. So I'm very happy that the orchestra asked for it, because it's not a piece, as I said, that it comes around all that often anymore, and it's been a few years since I've had the chance to play it.
Well, let's hear some of that as long as we've done the build-up for it, and maybe... is there a favorite movement, or would most violinists say, oh, it's the finale, it's got to be the finale when things really come
know.
Together?
I mean, I like all of it. That sounds like a total cop-out, but I really do.
Possible.
I think that the opening is so very beautiful, the introduction and the main first movement. The last movement, of course, is very, very fire and virtuosic. I think it's probably those two outer movements that have the melodies that people most often think of.
Well, let's get into some of that then. Would you like to hear maybe and have you heard this CD lately, this set of CDs lately?
I have not listened to that in years. Yeah, when I think I recorded all that Brooks stuff over a decade ago. So yeah, it's been a while. It's funny. I like keeping them on my shelf to prove that I did something with my life, but I don't listen to them a whole lot.
That's possibly true of most performers. This happens fairly often when there's somebody in here and I have a CD and they say, oh, that one. And then they listen and with rapt attention, and it's always interesting to hear what they're hearing.
Yeah, I heard a very funny story about, I think it was attributed to Misha Maisky, whether or not it actually happened, I don't know. But the story was that he decided to re-record the Bach suites when one day he went into a record shop and he heard a recording of the Bach suites and went up to the person at the counter and said, this is just absolutely terrible. Can you turn it off? Who is this person playing? And it was him.
That would sound like a good reason for re-recording. I don't think we're going to have that experience here with the opening movement of Brooks' Scottish Fantasy with James Ennis and company.
Thank you.
modern work in some ways, isn't it? The way it just kind of flows from one movement to the next.
Hmm. Yeah, it's nice the way that that it all works kind of quite continuously. I mean, there are some breaks between movements, but they're not real hard breaks, so to speak. So yeah, it's I mean, it's known as the Scottish fantasy, but the actual title is something really long and convoluted, like fantasy for violin and harp and orchestra, freely using Scottish folk melodies. It's kind of a mouthful, but
sounds Germanic.
Yeah, I think that he had an idea of using these beautiful tunes and writing this beautiful piece, but it did break a lot of barriers in terms of, well, formally speaking, I guess. But Brooke was always kind of like that. I mean, you think of his first and second violin concertos also are kind of unusual the way they're put together. So for someone who was very conservative musically in a lot of ways, there are some interesting things that he did that were a little off the beaten path.
What did you think of that?
I wasn't listening. Sounded okay, I guess.
It's okay for background music.
Yeah, not bad for background music. Exactly. That's exactly what I'm trying to say about my playing. No, it was nice to... Nice to hear it, and nice to play it live. Certainly, last night's rehearsal was a lot of fun.
And again, James Ennis will be performing it three times this weekend with the Madison Symphony: Friday night at 7:30, Saturday night at 8:00, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30. Also on the program, Haydn's Symphony Number 85 and Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances. It's been what, about 7 years since you won the Grammy?
Yeah, sure. That sounds so, about right.
So by now you might have enough perspective on it to be able to tell what difference it made in your life.
What to say about something like that? You know, I was surprised when it happened and honored, and I think these things, it's impossible to know why they happen and why they happen when they happen. It's best not to pay too much attention to it. I think, you know, you make a recording, the only person that you really know that you have control over pleasing or not is yourself. So I think that whenever I make a CD, I hope that I'm happy with it, and if I'm happy with it, I just really have to trust that there will be enough other people that will be happy with it, that it will sell a few copies and lead to other things. I mean, certainly that particular recording, repertoire-wise, is the concertos of Barber and Korngold and Walton, and I think it could very well be because of that recording and receiving some attention that those are pieces that I end up playing a lot. But that's great. I mean, that's the reason
they're
I recorded
pieces.
Them in the first place, is because I love to play them. Yeah, so really, I think that in the classical world, that's what you can hope to get out of recordings, is the opportunity to then play them live and play them for more people and expose them for the masterpieces that you hopefully feel them to be.
How does that whole Grammy process work? I mean, who nominates it?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No, I really...
At what point did you even know you were in the loop for a Grammy?
I don't know. Someone told me that I was nominated, and it was the actual ceremony out in L.A., it was in between. I was going to be at home in Florida, and it was possible that I could have gone out there, but I had just come home from one European trip and I was leaving like for Spain the next day or something. I thought, I'm not going to go all the way out to LA. I think there are five nominees per category or something. So I thought, I've got a 20% chance. That's not worth going all the way out to LA.
Really?
And it was a completely ordinary day. I went out with my wife to Friendly's for lunch and came back and watched the webcast. And when they actually pronounced my name correctly, I thought, well, you know, that's a victory in itself.
You might have arrived.
I can be happy now. And then they announced it a second time as the winner. And that was, it was great.
I had a friend some years ago, about 10 years ago, who was nominated for an Oscar, and he thought, what are the odds?
Mm-hmm.
And only at the last second did he decide to show up, and he actually won. So he was glad that he actually paid some attention.
It ties into my sports superstitions, you know, like my favorite baseball team, the Boston Red Sox. When I go to actually see the Red Sox live, they always lose. When I've gone to playoff games, I am 0-5 for the Red Sox in playoff games. I mean, this is a team over the last bunch of years that has been really good, but... I'm a very, I think, rational person, and I know that this doesn't have anything to do with it, but I am going to think twice before, you know, if I have a chance to go to Red Sox playoff game, I might not go. So I think that was...
slightly perverse, that was, but I guess
yeah,
I see
yeah,
the
it's
logic.
Totally perverse, and I sometimes think, well, you know, in those kind of not very rational moments between, you know, wake and sleep or something where you think things that you realize don't make any sense. I have definitely thought at times, well, it's a good thing I didn't go out to the Grammys because if I'd gone out, I wouldn't have won. Like somehow that would have been the tipping factor.
I'm guessing you're not the only musician who has little superstitious quirks like that. We mentioned Pablo de Sarasate as not only one of the great violinists of the late 19th century, but also one of the great composers of virtuosic violin music. And you have a recorded CD that is half devoted to him. This was like 12 years ago or something now. Do you remember anything you can tell us about this particular piece, Zapariotto?
That's a piece I really love and have known for, it feels like, all my life. I think that that was on... I think that that piece was on a recording. It was one of my first violin recordings, a record that I got of Itzhak Perlman playing when I was a little kid. I didn't know how to pronounce the piece. I just called it Zippity Doodah because it sort of sounded like that to me. But it's one of my favorites. And that CD, actually, that I recorded is one I have a real soft spot for because it's just music of Wieniawski and Sarasate, just pieces that I really like. And I think sometimes there's so much sort of strategic thought put into recordings that it's nice to just basically say, I want to make this CD because I really like to play this stuff and I really like to listen to it myself.
That sounds like good criteria to me. Here it is then, Zapariotto, and the pianist here is Edward Laurel with James Ennis, the violinist. It does sound like fun if you can pull it off.
Oh, it's great fun to play. Yeah, it's tricky. I keep saying that about pieces.
Well,
they are hard. It's hard to play the violin.
They look hard. Do you ever feel it is hard to play? Quite agree. I mean, with very, very limited experience I've had with it, but just watching, how should I put this delicately? How much of it is like showbiz and making it look hard, and how much of it really is hard?
Well, that depends who you're
watching.
I mean, I don't think there's anything to be gained in trying to make something look hard. I mean, it's, as far as I'm concerned, any kind of extraneous stuff that's put in there is both phony and counterproductive because, you know, it's difficult enough to do it without making it harder by pulling faces and dancing all across the stage. But, you know, I mean, there are people that feel differently.
Well, we have another one here lined up from that same CD, actually. And we mentioned Henri Wieniawski and this Polonaise, which sounds, Polonaise by nature tends to be a pretty energetic piece.
Yeah. Well, Wieniawski, I think, was a very, very fine and very underrated composer. I mean, of course, a lot of his violin show pieces tend to really focus heavily on the show aspect of them, you know, lots of technical fireworks. But I think there's really beautiful music that he wrote. I mean, he was just such an unusual character and didn't live a terribly long life, partied pretty hard. There's all sorts of amazing stories.
We know about
of
those
his
violinists.
Oh, yeah. You can't trust us. his gambling was always getting him into trouble, where he'd acquire some beautiful violin and then he'd gamble it and lose it, and then have to find some new patron and get another violin and then gamble it and lose it. And fascinating person, and certainly left a great legacy of music.
And you've done, I think, these recordings we've heard so far on that Stradivarius, right?
Yeah, that's right. I've been using a 1715 Strad for about 16 years now. It's been my faithful companion, and it's a great joy. I mean, now I feel just as inspired by it and intrigued by what I can find in it than as I did all those years back when I first saw it.
It's a sign of a great piece of music or a great instrument.
I think so.
And so here's the Polonaise number 1 in D by Wieniawski. James Ennis, my guest today, the violinist. Little flourishes there at the end.
Oh, it's good fun.
you know when it's over.
Yeah, he makes it clear, right?
And now, parting words from James Ennis. He's playing again this weekend with the Madison Symphony, the Scottish Fantasy by Max Bruch, and he has a set of 2 CDs devoted entirely to the violin works. I don't think there are all that many, are there, of Bruch, but they're big ones.
Yeah, he wrote quite a bit for the violin. So yeah, the set I did has the 3 concertos and the Scottish Fantasy, all wonderful pieces.
Well, we'll look forward to the Scottish Fantasy this weekend or on the CD here on WPR. Thanks for stopping by.
Oh, thanks for having me in.
Always a pleasure.